view anyway. He's a treasure. You lean in and kiss him. The client called me an angel, you tell him. Even though you rescued Carl, you know in his nods he's struggling to find a greater truth in this. You'll prove him wrong. You'll prove everyone wrong. You grab the black handkerchief from the glove compartment and blindfold yourself, as is procedure. In the event someone ever captures you, the first thing they'll want to do is drug you with trance, so you'll reveal where you live. They'll get your supply and then kill you. Now that you have Carl, you've erased your address from your own memory and can relax knowing that someone can kill you, but they'll never find everything you've worked so hard to create. Your home has to remain a secret, even from yourself. You remove your blindfold after stepping through your front door. You let Carl deal with his bastard cat while you bullet straight to your memory bank. As you spin the dial of your vault, 248, because you tortured your father for 2 hours and 48 minutes before killing him, you wish you could just throw that cat out the window and make Carl forget it ever existed. But there are only a few things that make Carl happy, so you let the cat live, even though it hates you. See? You're good. You put others before you. You open your vault and put away the extra dazes and tokens you had on you in case that kid wanted more than just trance. You don't close it immediately. You nod in approval at all you've done. The client was right. You are an angel. You've come to the rescue for many who've gone through traumas. It's not as if painful memories shrink away as quickly as all your old childhood belongings melted the night you set your house on fire. Your services are needed. You've come a long way. The seeds here, particularly the gray daisies and green tokens, do good. The tokens will grow in someone's mind like a garden, where someone can grab a memory off a tree as if it were an apple. The daisies will blossom too, except they'll hide whatever memory needs to be hidden in its trails of thorny vines. You've come a long way, Slate, but there's still work to be done, and you know it. No matter how you or the others spin it, you know that what comes from the violet trance seeds is less of a garden and more of an abyss. But you're not the one creating the abyss or pushing others into it. You just hand others the shovel to dig that hole themselves. Except once. You were called an angel today. Prove it to yourself. In the colorful garden of green, gray, and violet seeds, there are a few pink ones. You pull out one pink seed and a pocket knife and close the vault. You play some classical music and meet Carl in the living room, joining him on the floor while the cat scratches the couch's armrest. Your flute of Chardonnay already awaits you on the diamond-shaped coffee table, as is routine in your household. You sit on the outrageously overpriced oriental rug you bought simply because you could, kicking one boot off your foot on the spot where you tracked in mud last week, and the other where you spat out Carl's favorite red wine. You're positive the seller would die of a heart attack if they saw the carpet today. You fall flat on your back, staring at yourself in the ceiling mirror, and let the music calm your pounding heart. Carl inches toward you with the Chardonnay.
You okay? You seem a little on edge.
Do you think I'm an angel? The mirror doesn't show you as an angel, but what the hell does a mirror know? Mirrors only know what you show them, not the other way around. Carl hovers over you, blocking your reflection, and smiles down at you.
I would have to be a clown's ass to think the girl who saved me from a burning bridge is anything less than angelic.
Would you love me if I didn't save you? You're not sure you want the answer, but the question is out there. But Carl's smile doesn't break.
No shit, Slate. I was just too busy thanking you after you saved me to fall in love with you.
When did you fall in love with me?
You know the answer,
he says. Maybe I forgot, you say.
Been dipping into your supply of days lately?
Tell me why you love me or I'll make you forget your parents, you joke.
Don't threaten me with a good time,
Carl says. He laughs. He stops hovering over you and lies beside you, taking your hand in his. You both look at the mirror above, the U-shaped constellations gazing back at you. The cat runs across the room like a shooting star, staring at its own reflection through the closed window.
I love how hard you work at creating a better world, Carl says, massaging your palm. I know everyone doesn't get it. I sometimes struggle with it too. But the police and mercenaries will eventually wake up to your good one day. I can't wait until we don't have to sneak into masquerade-themed proms just so we can dance together in public. And I hate how our first kiss at that Korean restaurant was in the dark corner instead of under all those lit lanterns. I wish everyone could see you for who you really are. They will soon enough.
He sits up, pulling you with him by your wrists.
Once you're done fixing the world.
He wants everyone to see you for who you really are, but he should see you before everyone can. You press one hand against his broad chest and gaze into his green eyes. Your other hand reaches for the pink seed in your pocket. He closes his eyes and leans in to kiss you, and you swiftly put the seed on the tip of your tongue. The kiss lights you up with the same electricity that it always does. Victory, as charged as a lightning storm and high-voltage love. The pink seed rolls into his mouth, dissolving on his tongue before he has the chance to realize it's there. The kiss twists within moments. You open your eyes when he goes still, beaming when he opens his own. You find terror, as expected, from someone who's no longer under trance and kissing someone he doesn't actually love. He rips himself away from you as you laugh.
You.
Me. You tilt your head and blow him a kiss.
Where am I?
Carl looks around, confused, and the only thing he recognizes is his cat. Well, there's you, of course, but that's obvious. You're unforgettable. You watch Carl's eyes as they scan the room. He spots the four-pronged candelabra, which would actually be a decent weapon in the hands of someone who wasn't scared of a fight, or at least knew how to make a fist. That person is not Carl. Not before, not now. You draw your pocket knife and flip it open, twirling it between your fingers. I wouldn't, you warn. You tap the flat of the blade against your cheek. Unless you want a mask, too.
You drugged me,
he says. Ah, there's that astute scientist brain of yours, Carl.
What? That's not my name,
Carl says. Yeah, well, Franklin is an old man's name.
It was passed down to me.
I didn't care for it. And you refuse to call Carl by that name.
It's all about you.
So what if it is? You step toward him, the pocket knife dancing between your fingers, and corner him between two oversized prints of modern art. You have a good thing going for you here, Carl. You and Retrieve kept getting in my way, but I'm merciful. I let you live, and more important, I gave you a new life. You haven't even said thank you.
You're an egomaniac,
Carl says. And you're unappreciative, you say. You're alive, for starters. I also let you keep that damn cat. You thought the cat would grow on you, but it's hard to love something that tries to scar your face further, leaving scratches on your cheek like tally marks. You take another couple of steps toward Carl, closing the space between you two, and press him against the wall with the hilt of your pocket knife. You roll the knife around and drag the tip of the blade up his chest and stop at his neck. Would you be happier, dead?
You won't kill me,
Carl says, avoiding your eyes. You grab his arm and whisper in his ear, I already have. He tenses with your breath against his face. I resurrected you, but you will die again. I don't have to shove a knife in your throat to do so. The city will forget about you, without days. All they need is time, and they'll forget about you the same way they do when airplanes vanish without a trace, or when children go missing.
My friends will find me,
Carl says. You shake your head. You're sure that tacky brute will have gunned down many of his friends by now. He's probably already on his way to drown himself. Corpses aren't exactly known for their detective skills, I'm afraid. You're missing Franklin Ledeau, and there won't be anyone around to find you by the end of the night. You laugh in his face, which an angel wouldn't do, you know this, but you can't help yourself. You create hope for many, and you're stealing it from the person who tried to undo all your work. You're not one for poetry, but you can stomach it this time. He tackles you, while you're laughing, like a true coward, and he actually manages to take you down. You clutch the pocket knife, ready to swing it across his throat in self-defense, but he pins your arm down with his knee and strikes you in the face with his elbow. He punches you, flesh on dead flesh on flesh. He goes for your mask, peeling it off your face. Your face disarms him more than your mask ever has. He's not disgusted by the scars on your face. He's surprised. You strike him in the back with your knee, and he flies off you. You roll backward onto him, twisting your body and locking your hand around his throat. You lean in as if you were going to kiss him, but Carl is at his worst, most repugnant self right now. Franklin. "You said you wanted the world to see me as I am," you say, ignoring the confusion on his face since he doesn't actually recall any of this. Not what he said to you, not any of those romantic moments you shared together at proms or Korean restaurants, nothing. But you know all this, and you're all that matters. "Here I am." He doesn't look away from your face, not even to see if the pocket knife in your other hand is inching closer to him. His life could be stolen at any moment now, if you choose to strangle him or snap his neck. But, with great concern and strain, he asks,
"What happened to you?"
He hasn't even asked about himself. He has no idea that months ago you drugged him with trance in the middle of the night while he was asleep in his lab working on a pill that could prevent your seeds from ever taking hold, with no one but that bastard cat keeping him company. And yet he asks what happened to you, what your past is. You help others, but you don't care for them. And aren't angels supposed to care? "Bad parenting happened," you find yourself admitting for the first time ever. "My father took his cruelty out on me, and I finally gained control when I stole his life." Saying all this out loud reminds you of childhood, when you wanted to hear fairy tales of princesses being saved from dragons by knights. Except growing up in your household taught you two important things. You have to be in charge of telling your own story, and sometimes the princess needs to get off her ass, pick up a sword, and slay the dragon herself. Your happily ever after began when your father's life ended. And now you wear the crown and wield the sword at all times.
"I'm sorry," Franklin says. "I didn't know. But none of this makes you entitled to someone else's life. Let me go. Turn yourself in. We can get you the help you need. You'll never be innocent again, but you don't have to be so guilty."
It's touching how much you care. Too bad you won't remember trying to be the hero. Franklin shakes his head.
"You will. Good luck living with yourself."
You slam the hilt of your pocket knife into his forehead, knocking him out. You climb off him, kicking his side to make sure he's actually laid out. No groans, no winces. You ignore his cat's meowing and walk over to your memory bank to grab another trance seed. You catch your reflection in the mirror. There's no mask hiding you at your purest. An angel. The word doesn't feel right, and it's not because of the scars on your face. You could have killed Franklin instead of taking his memories hostage and hiding them behind an identity of your making, but you continued to let him breathe. This is a fate his friends weren't offered, a privilege his friends weren't offered. Franklin is a trophy you parade around, not simply put away in a case to collect dust. He tried to beat you, and you won, fair and square. Now he gets to serve you. And while angels serve the people, they above all bow before a single voice. "You're a god," you remind yourself. You smile and return to Franklin's body. Maybe he's not exactly a dragon. Maybe you're not the angel the client believed you to be. But this life is still one of your own design, and that's the way you like it. You roll the trance seed around your fist, imagining what life you'll design for him next. Every name he's worn so far will remain good and buried, but he's in excellent hands with you. The world knows this. You'll make a name for him, and no one will remember the old ones. Katrina Feeney's Villain Challenge to Adam Silvera. A female teen crime lord concealed by a mask. Behind the Villain's Mask by Katrina Feeney. My original idea for Adam Silvera's villain prompt was inspired by a blend of the supervillains Harley Quinn and the Joker. The combination of their sociopathic tendencies, energy, agility, and intelligence left so much room for exciting evildoing, and a big part of their characters is the masks of makeup they wear. I could only imagine the fun Adam had, playing around with the possibilities while exploring Slate's character. The mask itself is one of the things I love most about Adam's story. The imagery and the history behind it drew me in, while simultaneously repelling me with its grotesqueness. Paired with the narrative, Slate's physical mask points toward the metaphorical masks that we ourselves wear. Everyone puts on facades at certain times for various reasons, whether to exert a sense of professionalism when dealing with customers or to display our very best side on a first date. We use different masks to present different sides of ourselves to those around us. However, the way in which we are perceived isn't solely dependent on our own individual output. We can't always manipulate how others see us, as often there are also societal expectations and assumptions that come into play. But when you actively choose to put on a mask that has certain meanings, you can subvert or control how the other people see you. Slate undermines those expectations. Her scar-covered face does not fall within the prescribed ideas of beauty as defined by our present culture, nor does the mask of rotted flesh she wears to cover those very scars. Slate's mask's purpose is not to fit in and conform to societal beauty standards and present an idealized image of the female face. The mask is Slate's face. It is the image people recognize as belonging to the crime lord. Rather than attract, it repels and disgusts people. Most importantly, it is a trophy that also embodies Slate's strength and control. Furthermore, Slate does not act like your typical 18-year-old girl. I can't say that I know any teen crime lords, but then again, they wouldn't reveal their identity to me. She certainly acts in questionable ways, which is what I find so fascinating. Slate is ruthless and unforgiving, having been hardened and sharpened into a calculating and resourceful villain with really creative ways of obtaining what she desires without getting her hands dirty. But most of all, I love how she is her own knight in rusty armor. She doesn't want or need saving from anyone, and she wears a mask all her own. So what does your mask say about you? Hero or villain, you must hide your identity when you are saving the world or trying to destroy it. You look at the masks lined up side by side. Your fingers trace a smooth jawline as you decide which will be your new face. You hesitate for a second before ultimately going with your gut instinct. You fasten the mask to your face. Was it the eye mask? Some say the eyes are the windows to the soul, and you like to let people in, but only a little. You allow others to learn a bit of your deepest self before they get to truly know the everyday you. Maybe it's a way to repel people from the start, to not get hurt down the track. Or maybe you're too afraid to open up to people on your own, so you give them the opportunity to look and see for themselves. The animal mask. There is something within you that you are desperate to hide. Unfortunately, it isn't so deep down that others can't see it, so you wear the face of an animal just in case. If you slip up or reveal too much, you can blame it all on the beast. You are just in character, you say, merely playing a part. That's all. The lace/half-face mask. You like to intrigue people and keep them on their toes. You maintain an air of mystery that only serves to entice people. They feel like they know you from the half-clear view they can see, but they don't quite realize that you're masking so much more beneath the thin veil covering your face. The Anonymous Mask. You are a natural leader and like to control how others perceive you. More than just that, you know how to influence how people see you, and this mask does the job just right. Perhaps it is the face of another, or perhaps it is a representation of one of your own many faces. Either way, you aren't hiding behind the mask, merely using it to force people's gaze. The Painted Face. You are comfortable with who you are, and by manipulating the paint, you can highlight and accentuate the traits you want the world to see, front and center. No matter how vibrant or abstract that layer of color, it is entirely and completely you.
Julian Breaks Every Rule by Andrew Smith. This is not sperm day. Stephen Kemple would not die. Maybe Stephen Kemple wouldn't die because I knew his real name. So every time I think of him, it's always Stephen Kemple, Stephen Kemple, Stephen Kemple. All my other victims, crazy hat lady, Camaro douchebag, unfriendly bicycle meth head, I just kind of naturally made up their names. This was Iowa, after all, and anonymity here was as rare as an ocean breeze. I preferred not to know anything at all about the strangers who lived on the streets around my house, especially the ones I'd killed. Everyone else knew everything about everyone. That's how small towns like Ealing are. We all go to the same church and the same school, shop at the same market, fire up the barbecues on the same days, shovel the same snow, step in the same dog shit. And I hated Stephen Kemple. You probably already hate Stephen Kemple, too, at least a little bit. You kind of hate the way his name sounds. And I haven't even told you anything about Stephen Kemple yet, about the oatmeal thing, or how he'd handcuffed me in my underwear to a drinking fountain when we were in middle school, or the party I had. Who knows? Maybe Stephen Kemple will die at the end of this story, which may or may not be foreshadowing. Don't skip ahead. But the fucker would not die. Last week, this was in biology class at Hoover High, my best friend Dennis told me this. You know what I hate most of all about you, Julian? You can break any rule and nobody gives a shit. You could fucking murder someone right here at school, and all the teachers would be like, so what if Julian killed someone? We all love Julian. In many ways, Dennis was right. Also, it's okay for guys to hate certain things about their best friends, like if you had a friend who was really, really good-looking and confident around girls, or if your friend, like me, could get away with anything. I had always been like that. The getting away with things part, not the confident and good-looking thing. I can't explain it. I'd hate it, too, if I weren't me. But you're not allowed to. Your job is to hate Stephen Kemple. I'll bet that just now, when I said Stephen Kemple, it was like someone poked a rusty knitting needle slowly through your eyeball and into the center of your brain, and you're probably like, man, I sure hope Julian kills Stephen Kemple soon. Because I'm like that. Dennis didn't know how right he was when he said I could get away with murder. Oh, one more thing about saying names. Dennis, D-E-N-I-C, is pronounced Dennis. Don't ask me why, even though now you'll probably need to go back and reread the last page so you can erase the Denick or whatever your stabbed brain has been narrating to you. You'd have to ask Dennis's parents why his name is spelled that way. After all, they named him. So, that day in Mr. Kang's biology class, when Dennis griped about my talent for getting away with anything, and let's face it, it really is a kind of superpower, we were doing a lab involving looking at epithelial cells, which was extremely gross and awkward because our lab group included Catherine Huxley and Amanda Flores, who were easily the most all-around together 10th grade girls at Hoover. I'd never had the guts to talk to either of them, being the skinny loser that I was, and now here we were, thrust together in a compulsory assignment where we would have to discuss tissue samples harvested from our own bodies. Like I said, it was gross and awkward. Talking about my own personal epithelial tissue in front of Catherine Huxley and Amanda Flores was every bit as humiliating as being handcuffed to a public drinking fountain in my underwear in the middle of Bloomer Park, which is something I know about, but naturally did not get in trouble for. Nothing, on the other hand, could deflate Stephen Kempel's self-image. Stephen Kempel, whom I hated immensely and who also would not die, was our fifth lab partner. Catherine Huxley was horrified. He can't actually expect me to do that. The he was Mr. Kang, and the that was scraping the insides of our cheeks, the ones on our faces, with a toothpick to goop out some of our epithelial tissue, which we would then smear like butter onto a glass slide and examine under the microscope. "I'll do it," Stephen Kempel said. Then he hooked an index finger inside his cheek and began mowing his flesh with the toothpick as he drooled and spluttered something barely intelligible that included the words volunteer and sperm day. I was disgusted by two things. First, that Stephen Kempel would openly talk about his own sperm in front of Catherine Huxley and Amanda Flores, while he had his hands in his mouth, no less. And second, the size of the tissue sample Stephen Kempel extracted from his face. It looked like a pale, miniature leg of lamb. Amanda Flores's mouth curled down so tightly it was almost like she could turn her face inside out. Dennis leaned in to inspect the object at the end of Stephen Kempel's toothpick and said, "Dude, did you just give birth?" Then Dennis added, "Hey, that's a piece of oatmeal." Stephen Kempel rotated his wrist like he was a jeweler holding a rare diamond. "Yeah, it is oatmeal, from yesterday. I had waffles today." I could have vomited, but it would have been too embarrassing in front of Catherine Huxley and Amanda Flores. Then Stephen Kempel pointed his mouth baby at me and said, "We should use some of Powell's." Here's another reason why I hated Stephen Kempel. To Stephen Kempel, all boys were last names. To Stephen Kempel, life itself was a continuous gym class. But the thing Stephen Kempel did next was why he should have died that day, because anyone else who did it would have. Stephen Kempel wiped his day-old mouth baby oatmeal on my left shoulder. But Stephen Kempel didn't die. He could have swigged a pint of antifreeze, and the fucker would not die. You hate him, don't you? Crazy Hat Lady. Let me explain. Crazy Hat Lady was the first. Crazy Hat Lady used to yell at me for running past her yard and making her dogs bark at me. Did you notice I referred to Crazy Hat Lady in past tense? Yeah. That's major foreshadowing, too. Of course, I did not know Crazy Hat Lady's real name, but she always wore hats, and I assumed she was crazy because there was never any reason for her to get mad and thrash her arms wildly and yell at me just because her stupid dogs barked at me whenever I ran by. I like to run. Present tense, so you know everything ends with running shoes and a pulse for me. The incident with Crazy Hat Lady happened 2 years before Stephen Kempel talked about sperm day in Mr. Kang's biology class at Hoover High. Dennis and I, who've been friends since we were in kindergarten, were tough guy eighth graders, about to be liberated from Henry A. Wallace Middle School. Iowans like to name their schools after prominent politicians who came from Iowa, as if to assert to the rest of the world that Iowa exists, and people who are not actually invisible come from here. Don't Google Henry A. Wallace. He was a vice president. A dirt path through vacant fields connects the street I live on with Onondaga Street, which runs straight down to the creek I like to run along. The path also goes right next to Crazy Hat Lady's former house. That day, as usual, Crazy Hat Lady's two dogs, a long-haired wiener dog, and an overweight shepherd chow mutt, were behind a low cedar fence, running around like crazed convicts in Crazy Hat Lady's front yard. And that day, as usual, Crazy Hat Lady's dogs launched themselves into a hysteria of agonized barking when I came running up through the field. Crazy Hat Lady opened her front door, flailing her arms at me.
"Why do you have to run here? Look at what you do to my dogs! Leave us alone! How dare you do this to us?"
She wore a leopard print pillbox hat with a black mesh net that looked like one of those sacks you buy tangerines in, and a black pheasant feather spearing out of its top. I never answered her. I felt her line of interrogation was more rhetorical than inquisitive. But that day, just as I cleared the field and came out onto Onondaga, two things happened. First, Crazy Hat Lady's mutt scaled the short wooden fence around her front yard, and second, our local state trooper, Clayton Axelrod, rounded the corner in his patrol vehicle. So he saw everything. The dog ran at me. Crazy Hat Lady ran for her dog.
"Leave my dogs alone!"
I caught a glimpse, but only a glimpse, of her arms flailing as though she were attempting to extinguish invisible flames bursting from the top of her leopard print pillbox hat. The dog clamped his yellow teeth on my left wrist. I realized something at just that moment. When a dog is biting you, shaking its head frantically as though attempting to remove a mouthful of flesh, it makes you really want to live. So I was kind of grateful, but only momentarily, to the dog for making me aware of just how much I loved my life.
"Leave my dog alone, you little prick!"
Crazy Hat Lady yelled. I slid my free hand inside the dog's collar and twisted. The dog began choking. I think, at that moment, because of a lack of oxygen, Crazy Hat Lady's dog realized how much he loved his life, too. In fact, there was so much love of life going on there on that morning beside the creek, it was almost as though the dog and I had gone on a weekend retreat to one of those motivational seminars for depressed businessmen. Trooper Axelrod got out of his vehicle. Crazy Hat Lady, who ran very slowly, flailed and yelled,
"Get the fuck away from my dog, you piece of shit!"
Trooper Axelrod, who wore very nice, shiny leather gloves, managed to grab the dog by the scruff of his ample neck fur. The dog unclamped from my bloody wrist, and Trooper Axelrod said, "Okay, you can let go of him." As soon as I untwisted my right hand from the dog's collar, the fucker bit me again. Thanks, Trooper Axelrod. That was when Crazy Hat Lady finally caught up to us, yelling at Trooper Axelrod and me to get the fuck away from her dogs and her house. I ended up with my mom and dad in the emergency room. I got 4 stitches and a tetanus shot in the left cheek of my pale, skinny butt, which everyone in the room, including the doctor, a nurse, Trooper Axelrod, my mother, and my father, looked at. I hated Crazy Hat Lady and her stupid dogs so much. And right when the needle was going in, that was when it happened for the first time. I thought, I wish Crazy Hat Lady would die. Wishes, like the thought of death, are almost always foreshadowing, and I wanted her dead. You might think that's an intense overreaction to the situation, but not me. Death was called for, in my opinion. My day was ruined. but probably not as much as crazy hat ladies would be, which is major foreshadowing. In Ealing, a town where nothing ever happens, and anyone who doesn't live here is only passing through, either in one direction toward Waterloo or Cedar Falls, or in the other direction toward Iowa City, there is a gas station slash peanut brittle and venison jerky shop slash petting zoo called Bill and Carol's. The peanut brittle and deer jerky are not made there, even though the owners pretend that they are, and the petting zoo is the dumbest thing I have ever seen in my life. All the animals except three have died. The three animals in the Bill and Carol's peanut brittle and jerky petting zoo that are still alive are a desert tortoise, a chihuahua with three legs, and a 24-foot-long Malaysian reticulated python. The python would not eat the tortoise because of its shell, and the chihuahua is very nimble, more so than the other animals that used to be part of the zoo's collection. So that day, at approximately the same time that my naked 13-year-old butt was being stared at by my mom and dad and a bunch of strangers in the emergency room of Ealing's Angel of Mercy Lutheran Hospital, Bill and Carol's 24-foot-long Malaysian reticulated python, which was named Eddie, escaped from their woeful petting zoo and made its way down Onondaga Street into Crazy Hat Lady's front yard. Naturally, Crazy Hat Lady's long-haired wiener dog barked, yapped, and flung glistening strands of saliva. The other dog, the one that had bitten me, had been carted off to the dog pound to think about what he'd done for 48 hours. But Crazy Hat Lady, on hearing the commotion in her yard, assumed that the annoying runt who liked to torment her poor dogs had come back, running on the path beside her yard, which is what the little fucker liked to do. She was wearing a lavender cloche with what looked like a bow tie pinned to its band. Her big mistake, besides choosing a green frock, was making an attempt to wrestle her long-haired wiener dog away from Eddie, who coiled his elm tree of a body around and around and around Crazy Hat Lady. When I read about what had happened on Onondaga Street, I felt a little bit guilty, but only a little. Had I caused it by sheer will? Yeah, pretty sure I had. Over the next 2 years, after what happened to the others, a Camaro douchebag, unfriendly bicycle meth head, perverted angry substitute teacher, and a few others, I came to recognize the fact that I was Ealing, Iowa's little angel of death. It only took one little trespass on their part, and I would think, "You should die, Camaro douchebag, or unfriendly bicycle meth head, or whoever, and not just die, but die in the most strangely unpredictable manner imaginable. Like death by space junk, for example, which is what hit perverted angry substitute teacher when he was driving in his convertible Fiat, which is a fleet vehicle for perverts. Every last one of them died. I didn't ask why or how I controlled their fates. I just did. Which is why I couldn't, for the life of me, figure out why Stephen Kempel would not die. Don't be an idiot, Julian. The Friday after Stephen Kempel pulled something big enough to deserve a name and birth certificate from his mouth and smeared it on my Herbert Hoover High School cross-country team polo shirt in Mr. Kang's biology class, Mom and Dad went to Minneapolis for 3 days. "You know the rules, Julian," my dad told me before they both kissed me on the forehead and climbed into the Prius. Of course, it didn't matter what the rules were. I could break every one of them, leave bloody corpses strewn throughout the living room, and Mom and Dad wouldn't even notice. This is probably foreshadowing. Mom, who did not wear hats, slid her window down and waved, "And call us every night." They gave me permission to have a party, but let me be clear. party to a skinny, dorky 15-year-old from Ealing, Iowa, named Julian Powell, meant my best friend Dennis was allowed to come over and spend the night, and we'd stay up late eating pizza and playing the dorkiest, most violent video game that was our current obsession, which was called Battle Quest, Take No Prisoners. Dennis came over at 5. The delivery guy from Stan's Pizza, a senior named Scott Neufeld, who was also on the Hoover High cross-country team, knocked on the door when Dennis and I were about an hour into Battle Quest, Take No Prisoners. I thought it was odd that Dennis had ordered 4 pizzas from Stan's. We usually couldn't even finish one. "Are you starving or something?" I said. Dennis carried the stack of pizza boxes into the living room. "No. You'll never guess what I did," Dennis said. "Lost a bet that involved making an entire pair of pants out of 4 extra-large Stan's pizzas," I guessed. "No," Dennis said. "I invited Catherine and Amanda over, and they said yes." "Did they tell you they eat a lot?" "No, I just... Don't be an idiot, Julian." I will admit that it was simultaneously thrilling and terrifying to think of being alone in my house on a Friday night with Catherine Huxley and Amanda Florence. "Why did you invite them?" I asked. "Are you out of your mind?" I was certain Dennis's question was purely rhetorical. "But I'm in pajama bottoms and a t-shirt," I pointed out to the fully dressed Dennis. In fact, it was just at that moment that 2 things happened. First, the doorbell rang, which is not really foreshadowing because you already know who rang it, and it was someone named either Catherine Huxley or possibly Amanda Flores. And second, I not only realized that Dennis was fully dressed, but that he was dressed nice, like school dance nice, which is something a 15-year-old guy would never notice about his best friend unless he found himself in a situation where he was embarrassingly underdressed in the impending presence of 2 very beautiful and smart, popular 15-year-old girls. "You fucker," I said. Dennis waved his hand dismissively. "They'll think it's sexy." "Then you should put on pajamas, too. Don't be an idiot. You know I sleep in my boxers. I'll lend you some of mine." The doorbell rang again, while Dennis and I argued about fashion and sleepwear. Dennis repeated the mantra of the evening, "Don't be an idiot, Julian. Answer the door." Amanda Flores laughed at me. "Don't tell me this is a pajama party. What are you, in 4th grade?" I was pretty sure those were rhetorical questions. And my pajama bottoms had 1953 Chevy pickups on them. "No, I, always dress like this, when I..." Dennis pushed past me and opened the door all the way so that Catherine Huxley and Amanda Flores could see that he was dressed like a 10th grader, as opposed to a shoeless 4th grader with little red trucks on his pajamas. He said, "Hi, Catherine. Hi, Amanda. Are you hungry? We got Stan's. Come in." I kind of hated Dennis at that exact moment, but not the kind of hate that would cause him to be crushed by a reticulated python or end up strangled by a windbreaker that got pinched in the rubber rail of an escalator, which is what happened last April to Camaro Douchebag, the day he intentionally splashed me with mud when I was running. And like I said, it's perfectly okay for best friends to hate each other from time to time. It wasn't the kind of hate I had for Stephen Kempel. Catherine and Amanda followed the very nicely dressed Dennis into my living room. Catherine said, "Are your parents gone?" She sounded so sexy and daring when she asked it. I nearly passed out, which would have been super embarrassing. I managed to squeak out an answer. "Yes, they went to Minneapolis till Sunday." "Nice socks," Amanda said. "Hey, aren't you the kid who got handcuffed to the drinking fountain in his underwear at Bloomer Park when we were in 6th grade?" "It was 7th, Dennis pointed out. My socks didn't match. I hadn't noticed until Amanda Flores pointed it out. One was gray and one was white. This was turning out to be the worst night of my life, which, as you have probably guessed, is major foreshadowing. Amanda and Dennis got pizza and sat on the couch. I, the statue of an idiot kid in mismatched, saggy socks and pajamas with trucks on them, stood in the middle of the floor, uncertain I would ever move again. Catherine Huxley had her phone out. She was texting something, possibly begging for anyone she knew to rescue her from the hell of pizza and video games with that kid who had been handcuffed in his briefs for 6 hours to a drinking fountain in the park. The Ealing newspaper ran photos of it. And did Stephen Kempel die? No, no, he did not. But what Catherine Huxley was actually texting, I came to realize later, was the address of my house. She was texting it to pretty much the entire student body of Herbert Hoover High School. Because this was where the party was. Stephen Kempel ruins my party, which is major foreshadowing. So that was how my dorky party, which was just supposed to be me, in my pajamas with trucks on them, and my best friend Dennis, who was dressed like a model in the Teens of Style section of the JCPenney catalog, blew up. Once Catherine Huxley sent out her text message, there was no stopping it. I learned a lot of things I never really wanted to know about real teenager parties that night. Like, for example, how once it's been confirmed there are no adults hiding out, random strangers between the ages of like 12 and 18 simply let themselves inside your house from any available unlocked door or possibly window. Dennis, nicely dressed and eating pizza on the couch with Catherine and Amanda, was teaching the girls how to play Battle Quest Take No Prisoners, while I, still standing like an idiot in the middle of the living room, was having an internal argument about whether I should excuse myself and change into some 10th grader clothes, or maybe at least get a robe. Dennis sat between the girls, who laughed and bounced, their legs pressed up against Dennis like he was trapped in a place where you could die the most blissful death. I'll admit it, I was jealous. I sat down beside Catherine, but not close enough to touch her, since I was only wearing pajamas and that would have probably given me an aneurysm. I tried to will myself to relax and just have fun, like the other kids were doing, but that was exactly when the first of what would turn out to be more than 100 unexpected guests simply opened the front door without knocking and let himself in. It was Stephen Kempel. It was Stephen Kempel, carrying a 12-pack of beer. "Where's the fridge?" Stephen Kempel said. "You can't bring that in my house," I said, but what I actually thought was, "Why won't you die, Stephen Kempel?" "Ha ha," Stephen Kempel laughed. Then he tore open the top of the 12-pack and handed cans of beer to the girls. He held one out for Dennis, who looked at me. I could tell Dennis wanted a beer too, but I was relieved when he said, "No thanks." "Hey, Stans!" Stephen Kempel swooped over to the pizza boxes. I stood up, fully prepared to at least attempt to throw Stephen Kempel out of my house. Catherine Huxley and Amanda Flores were already drinking beer. And Stephen Kempel pointed the bottom of his beer can at me and said, "What are you, all ready for bedtime, Powell?" I hated Stephen Kempel so much. Then the door opened again, and at least a dozen kids I recognized from Hoover High let themselves in. They were juniors or seniors, and I was instantly terrified. Two of the boys in front of the pack had wispy beards. They carried a beer keg between them. "Hey, pajama boy," one of the beer keg dudes said, "which way to the backyard?" And I thought, "You can't call me pajama boy, stupid beard beer keg dude." Ball return machine, Ealing 24-hour Bolarama. It was already too late to stop it, which is more foreshadowing than you need at this point. It was all a blur, Within half an hour, my house was full of kids. Someone had commandeered my parents' entertainment system. Music blared. The living room became a dance club. The sofa, where I should have been playing video games alone with my best friend, some kind of no-limits hookup station. The entire house reeked of booze and cigarettes and vape mist. I lost Dennis when I went outside, which was even worse than inside. The backyard was jammed with kids. There was a funnel connected to a hose, and kids were using it to down entire cans of beer in single gulps. Everywhere, kids were smoking pot, too. My yard smelled like the boys' locker room at Hoover. At least six boys were peeing on our back fence, which had turned into some massive public urinal. A kid who had just disconnected from the funnel hose beer contraption sprayed vomit toward a group of boys and girls who were smoking pot. They scattered frantically. It looked like the running of the bulls, except it was Iowa and not Spain, with barf instead of bulls. I felt dizzy. Also, my socks were wet. I hoped it was only beer, but it probably wasn't. "Hey, kid, your turn." Skinny, super-white, hairless senior dude who apparently didn't know how to button his fucking dress shirt so he could show off his actual tattoo to eighth-grade girls, held the mouth end of the beer funnel hose out for me. I fell asleep inside the cardboard baler at the Hy-Vee. No thanks. I decided I was going to call the cops on myself. I waded through the sea of idiots and pushed my way back inside the house. Seven kids were playing strip poker at the same dinner table where we have Christmas and Thanksgiving. I wanted to scream, but I was momentarily mesmerized by Amanda Flores's see-through bra. I had never seen an actual girl in an actual bra. Then I realized Dennis was playing too. He was down to his boxers. And everyone was laughing because Stephen Kemple had just lost and was completely naked. In my house, sitting on one of our dining chairs, I decided then and there I would never eat again. Dennis looked at me apologetically and shrugged. "I don't know how this happened." I mentally counted the layers of Dennis's really nice outfit. "Apparently you lost at least five hands is how it happened, Dennis." Then, naked Stephen Kemple stood up and grabbed my arm. "You can't watch if you don't play. Sit down, Powell." I was being touched by naked Stephen Kemple. It was all too much. I hated Stephen Kemple so much, but Stephen Kemple just would not die. I tugged my arm free from the grasp of naked Stephen Kemple, who made the wise decision to not chase me through the crowded living room dance floor and upstairs to my bedroom. So, after being scolded not to cut ahead by the half-dozen girls waiting in line outside my bathroom, after walking in on indistinguishable grunting couple having sex in my bedroom where nobody had ever had sex as a couple, hairdryer short circuit, grain silo mishap, I managed to get to my parents' thankfully unoccupied room and call the state troopers to shut down the party. I put my face in my hands. There was a knock on the door. Dennis came in. He sat next to me on my parents' bed. "Dude, I am so sorry about all this. Why are you still in your boxers?" "Two reasons. First, I didn't lose, and second, because Stephen Kemple put everyone's clothes in the bonfire." "There's a bonfire?" "It's outside, at least," Dennis said. That was thoughtful of them. Dennis nodded. "Yeah. Is Stephen Kemple still naked?" "Totally. I fucking hate Stephen Kemple." "Dude, totally." When the state troopers arrived at my front door, I answered it, still in my pajamas and soggy, mismatched socks. Unfortunately for me, the responding officer was Trooper Clayton Axelrod, who had kind of adopted me since the day he saved me from crazy hat lady's dog and then stared at my ass while I got a tetanus shot. He actually scruffed my hair and smiled when he saw me at the door. It was disgusting. Nobody is allowed to scruff my hair, no matter what size gun you're carrying. "Hey, Julian, how are you? How's your arm doing?" Every time Trooper Axelrod saw me, he'd ask about my arm, as though it had been miraculously surgically reattached or something. "Oh, fine, fine, Trooper Axelrod," I said. Animalistic screams rose from the backyard, and the house seemed to be belching out the combined smells of urine, pot, beer, and cigarettes, carried on wave after wave of pulsing EDM right into Trooper Axelrod's face. Trooper Axelrod looked behind me at Dennis, who was standing there in his boxers. "Looks like you boys are having a slumber party," Trooper Axelrod said. "No, Trooper Axelrod, kids are drinking, they're smoking pot, they're totally out of control, and they need to go home," I said. "Ha ha," Trooper Axelrod chuckled. "You never do anything wrong, Julian. Just have fun, and don't stay up too late. What a jokester." Then Trooper Axelrod spun around and walked back to his patrol vehicle. He called out over his shoulder as he got inside, "Just let me know if you want me to phone in an order to stands for you boys, Julian." Then he drove away. "How do you do that?" Dennis asked. "I fucking hate myself." Sunrises are all about foreshadowing. The party did not empty out until 4 in the morning, just when the sky in the east began to pale to a yellowish gray that reminded me of all the vomit in the backyard. Well, the party didn't totally empty out. Disgusting 12th grade back hair guy in tidy whiteys had passed out on the floor beneath the dining room table. Unattended open manhole cover. I had to actually touch him to wake him up, and then lie by saying everyone was waiting for him at the pancake house over on Kimber Drive, and that walking there in his underwear was totally fine with all concerned parties. He thanked me and said I was the best friend he'd ever had in the world. Dennis and I walked through a minefield of crushed beer cans on the floor of the living room. Outside, in the piss swamp of my backyard, it looked like we'd been struck by a meteor where the bonfire still smoldered. Dennis stood at the edge of the crater and shook his head. Those were really nice clothes. "They were so nice, I wanted to punch you in the face," I pointed out. "Well, admit it. You know you're not going to get in trouble for any of this when your parents come home tomorrow." I said, "Yeah, probably not." Dennis yawned. "You want to go in and play BQTNP? "Sure." I'm sorry if this disappoints you, but as much as you and I both may hate him, Stephen Kempel did not die that day. Neither did Catherine Huxley, who probably deserved to die for blowing up a party that was only supposed to be me and Dennis, and maybe those two girls, too, but that was it. Definitely not naked Stephen Kempel, who would not die, and whose naked image is now permanently seared into the flesh of my tormented brain. My parents came home on Sunday. Dennis and I had managed to clean everything up, and except for the smell of pee and the big burned circle in the backyard, things were pretty much just as they'd always been. And Mom and Dad believed our story about the giant meteor that smelled like a urinal, but everyone knew they would. After all, Ealing, Iowa's little angel of death could break any rule he wanted. He could even try to turn himself into the cops, and nobody would ever blame him for anything. But Stephen Kempel just would not die. And sometimes even little angels of death need to resort to more worldly methods and take matters of the flesh and bone into their own hands. It's a dirty business, balancing the ledgers of the universe. But somebody's got to do it. I know where Stephen Kempel lives, and this is major foreshadowing. Raylene LeMay's villain challenge to Andrew Smith, a psychopath in a futuristic setting. Julian Powell, Teen Psycho Extraordinaire by Raylene LeMay. I love psychopaths. Okay, that came out wrong. What I mean to say is I love watching